Welcome back to another episode of The Dirty Inning. It couldn't have been timed more perfectly as the Phillies string together the last few dirty innings of their season as this terrible slog comes to a weird back-and-forth end.
Plus, the playoffs, right?
I'm Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight. With me is Dr. Trevor Strunk.
Hello, Trevor. Hi, hello. Justin.
As we record this, Trev, the Phillies had a game where their best pitcher, Aaron Nola, went out to square up with the Atlanta Braves, who have dominated the NL East for some time now. A big series for the Phillies, who just took 2 out of 3 from the Mets. And if they have any playoff hopes, with mathematically they do, then winning this series would be a pretty good place to start as far as miracle runs go. Of course, they have to fight against the pretty much unstoppable Braves lineup. I don't know if you were watching the game tonight. I'm not sure if they've gotten Ronald Acuna out at all.
I'm not sure either. He seems to, and you know what's funny is I was looking at Ronald Acuna's numbers and like they're good, but they aren't as good as I thought they would be. And I think that's just because when he plays the Phillies, he turns into 2004 Barry Bonds.
You know, when you look at Ronald Acuna's numbers, I totally disagree with you. Actually, last night we on Hidden Season, on Hidden Season, I threw this little fact in there. Maybe you're not aware of this either, but didn't you know that Ronald Acuna Jr. hit 22 home runs in the month of July alone this year?
Wow!
Did you know that the Phillies that same month hit 33 home runs? Hey,
wonder what you're trying to get at here.
Yeah, pretty good stuff.
Boy, that sucks.
Yeah.
I mean, he's definitely one of the best players in baseball at this point. It's just like I think the disconnect for me is that his OBP is not particularly high for what his average is. Like, I think it's like 60 points above his average, which is good. But then you look at someone like Freeman, who has it like 90, almost 100 points above his average. And it's like, okay, that's the OBP I expect to see on like a quote unquote good player, because that was the era that I learned baseball in.
Well,
but I think Acuna's teaching me something different.
I mean, that's the thing. That's what we're facing when you face the Braves, is a bunch of guys who are really good in a lot of different ways. And just to correct myself, I was looking at Ronald Acuna's splits for his career, not just for this year. So when I said he hit 20, it was also August. So boy, I screwed that up in every
conceivable way. Shocked. I was like, he's not even at 40 yet, and he hit 22 in July. This is incredible.
Yeah, that was
what a month.
Totally incorrect, but his career is only 2 seasons long. So just, yeah, 22 home runs in the month of August. It is his hottest month by far.
All I'm saying is he's probably overrated.
Which is absurd. I know it's been kind of interesting watching more analytic baseball minds come to terms with the Ronald Acuñas and the Pete Alonzos that the Phillies see so much of playing in the NL East, because these are guys that, you know, if you're somebody who's like, oh, I really like guys who are like fast and smart and get on base and, you know, really they have their OBP numbers are up really high. Like, those guys aren't really those guys, but they're awesome and they're so
they're
much
very
fun.
Good. Yeah. It's the same with, like, if you look at all over the league, like Tim Anderson's the same way, where like, he's a guy who they're just like, how he walks like a 3% pace and his OBP is like 365. He has this crazy BABIP, but he's really hitting very well. What is this guy's deal? He should be really bad. And everyone just freaks out when they have to deal with it. It's like, this doesn't make sense. This isn't fair.
With the amount of brain meltings that happen when a new player is good and everyone is trying to figure out why, and it just doesn't make sense in the way that it's made sense to that point. It's like always like, oh, there's a new way to be good at baseball.
And it's funny.
It turns out it's hitting really cool home runs. Oh, Pete Alonso really cracked the code. Ronald Acuna is breaking baseball by hitting a lot of home runs.
Listen, he's going to Matt Kemp it, so in about 6 or 7 years, he's only going to be a replacement-level player.
Okay, I mean, in that you could replace him with 10 other players who combined would finally have the same number of home runs as him?
Some sort of bolt run. Yes, that's correct.
Well, it sucks that we have to speak so highly of players on other teams and not the Phillies. As we record this, you know, Aaron Nola gave up a bunch of runs early. The Braves are up 7-1, thanks in part to a Nick Pivetta relief appearance. Trev, have you seen enough of Nick Pivetta?
Would you say? I'm kind of done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at this point, it's beyond done, I feel like. So I bring him up because I wanted to ask, how many episodes of The Dirty Inning? Do you think we could do an entire season of episodes of The Dirty Inning just about Nick Pivetta? Or do you think he's not there yet? I don't think we have the exposure to him yet, but it certainly, at this point, feels like we've seen so many bad Nick Pivetta appearances.
He's there yet, because I think there's so many like Nick Pivetta moments where he was going to be good or did look good or kind of was okay or wasn't. Like, it never quite feels like he is I don't know how to say this. Like, it never quite feels like he's stringing together bad appearances in the way that, say, like, Danny's Baez or something like that was back in the day, where, like, you routinely could expect something horrible to happen.
but that's where I feel like we're at. I feel like this is...
We're getting there.
A routinely bad experience watching Nick Pivetta pitch.
Like, I mean, he's bad. Like, I don't know what to make of this team. Like, it's really hard to watch, and I'm more and more of the opinion that Gabe Kapler is just not good at this. Like, he's just, like, he's probably good at a lot of things in life. He probably is, like, has a lot of skills, and he certainly is, you know, more successful in his field than I am. So, like, you know, take it all with a grain of salt. But, like, I just don't think he's very good at this. Like, I think he's just not good at being a manager.
I'm glad you bring that up, because in this very game tonight, Gabe Kapler has pinch hit for Adam Haseley in center field. Then he pinch hit for Michael Franco at third base. And then he allowed his pitcher to hit. Why would you do that, Trevor?
What?
Are you okay?
I missed that. That took the wind out of me.
Yeah, that sounded like I really caught you off guard.
I just don't get it. Like, I just think he's not good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he pinch hit Adam Haseley with Scott Kingery. Then he pinch hit Michael Franco with Gabe Kapler's absolute favorite person in the universe, Sean Rodriguez.
Yes.
You know what? It looks like he had Jose Perella come in to bat for Edgar Garcia. But word was the pitcher was about to hit. But in any case,
wow.
What are we doing here, folks? Like, what are we doing?
Well, the thing I don't get is, like, so we have a manager who can't manage his players, and then we also have a pitching staff that is, like, woefully undermanned, and then a bunch of injuries. So it's like, okay, there's the general manager messed up. There's also bad luck, and then the manager is incompetent. It's like, well, I guess it's no wonder that they're not achieving expectations.
Well, this is going to be a great season to mine for Dirty Innings moving forward, and we've got some great episodes planned. We've got we're going to play with the format a little bit, I think, moving forward. But tonight we're just going to talk about Phillies team from not too long ago, Trev. We're going to journey back to a little time known as June 1995. Talk about a Phillies team that is honestly, unlike these 2019 Phillies, so much better than I would have expected or remembered.
It's a funny thing. Like, that's a team that when you said that, I just thought, oh, they had no expectations. And they probably didn't. I mean, that's after the strikes shortened season, so maybe they did. But I don't know. Like, it just feels like they wouldn't. And it's weird to hear that they were actually pretty good in some ways.
The thing about playing in the 90s on the eastern side of the country is that you're going to run into the Braves at some point regardless. And this was, of course, 1995. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was the 1 year of that 14 straight division title run for the Atlanta Braves when they actually managed to win the World Series.
I believe that's correct, yes.
So, you know, that was, they had sort of a, maybe not a team of destiny, but a team of dominance approach to baseball. So as far as the Phillies' expectations, it was like, yeah, you do what you can, but eventually you're going to run into the Braves. And we know those post-93 teams were still kind of like trying that duct tape together approach. There was no big key free agent who was acquired. I know that I feel like I've mentioned a few times in this era when my dad would tell me as a child, like, oh, the Phillies got this guy, the Phillies got this guy. And in my mind, it was like, that means he's good. They wouldn't get a player who wasn't good. Why would they get somebody who wasn't good? That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So every time he would say, oh, the Phillies got Andy Van Slyke or the Phillies got Mark Whitten, it would be like, oh, they have a new good player. And then eventually that would just fade away and it would be like, oh, that was like just nothing.
They weren't good at all. They were terrible.
They were not good. No. So June 30th, 1995 will be the game in question today on The Dirty Inning, a podcast in which that's what we do. We talk about the most obscure, dumbest, most forgotten, or hilarious innings in Phillies history. We have quite quite a cornucopia of options to choose from.
Justin, so, can you give me a bit of a tease? Because you gave the audience a bit of a tease. What's this? What's the format change? What are you thinking, buddy? I'm excited. I want to hear about it.
Well, you know, we do a bit of time traveling on this podcast. We always only go in one direction. So I feel like we're gonna be just toying with the idea of which direction we time travel in future episodes. So we'll see. We'll see what that opens up for us.
Incredible.
But, you know, we've traveled back to the age of swine flu, back to the age of yellow fever, back to the age of cholera. With these
and now we're back to the age of still reeling from Kurt Cobain's suicide.
Yeah, I was going to say, what is it? But that's about it. That's the main disease.
Trying to figure that out and playing Sega.
Trying to figure out how, you know, which games the Knuckles expansion pack worked with for your Sega.
Those were so fun.
That was the main priority of our nation in this era. But yeah, the Phillies, they were doing a little more than trying to jam two game packs into each other and then breaking their Sega Genesis by slamming the whole thing into it. Now, by the end of May, these 1995 Phillies were, they played 32 games by this point, Trev. What do you think their record was?
32 games. What was their record?
How many wins?
I'm going to give it an even 16-16.
Wow. In 32 games by the end of May, the Philadelphia Phillies were 23-9.
Oh, that's a lot better than I would have thought.
So good. I don't remember them being this good. And you know why?
Wow.
You know who was keying this offense? Jim Eisenreich.
.377.
Jim Eisenreich. Not a huge key player on that 1993 team with all the Dykstras and Crux and Daltons running around. Jim Eisenreich was, I believe, one of the platoons. They were platooning in their corner outfield spots.
That's correct, yeah.
In the middle infield. I mean, he wasn't even a guy getting... And at this point, he was not getting all of the starts in right field either. So that's
I feel like with someone like Eisenreich, once you get him outside of the space of the Crux and Dykstras and stuff, obviously a lot of those players from the 93 team were still there, so this is kind of like a weird way of saying it, but like when it's not that 93 team, the guys like that can sometimes shine.
Yeah, that's and he did, man. He was
that's cool.
On fire. Seeing that record, I was like, somebody on this team has to be absolutely destroying the ball. And knowing who the 1995 Phillies were, I was like, who was it? And then to rediscover that it was Eisenreich was like, oh man, that's eye-opening. But also there was Tony Longmire, who was hitting 400 in 37 plate appearances. Tony Longmire.
Is that,
oh my God.
That's the star of the hit detective show Longmire, is that right?
Yeah, I believe that's based on his exploits. Went on to become a small town sheriff who murdered at least 2 to 3 people weekly.
I've seen every episode of that show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tony Longmire. Hitting 400 at this point in his pre-law enforcement career and 37 plate appearances. As far as pitching, Curt Schilling was still around, but this rotation had Mike Mims, Paul Quantrill, and Tyler Green sitting in it. And they were putting up high threes and fours from the word go as far as ERA.
Yeah, this was the Tyler Green disappointment year, right? The sequel to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was Sid Fernandez had made 5 starts by the end of May, and his ERA was 8.35. And this is all with Heathcliff Slocum coming out to close the games.
Oh no, Heathcliff Slocum. We've talked about this guy so often. He's so bad.
Yeah, we did a whole episode based
I'm not happy Slocum. He's back. He just reminds me of Lance Broadway, but Lance Broadway didn't even really pitch. I don't know why I compare the two, but I just hate them.
Well, the Phillies were relying on pitching, defense, and just, they said clutch hitting. It was more like miraculous hitting to stay 3.5 games ahead of the Braves, who I don't know if you remember the 90s, but they were pretty okay in 1995 particularly.
Yeah, it's funny because like I think, there's a lot of debate about what went wrong with the Phillies rebuild, why the Braves are so much better, all this stuff. And yeah, like the Braves are better than the Phillies right now. I think it's undeniable. And how the Phillies get better than them, how they move on, all that stuff. It's really important. But like the Braves at this point with the pitching staff, they had those top three. And then, you know, they had like someone running through every so often for like 4 or 5 years who was like, would have, I mean, in some cases ended up being the Phillies' number one, but moving from their number four, like that team, and with Chipper Jones, I mean, that team just, that's a team that's never going to be replicated. That was just like an unbelievably dominant team.
God, I hope not. I hope that's
I don't think it can be. It's just like, it's impossible. It's completely implausible in today's MLB.
Well, the Phillies also had, this was the era of Greg Jeffries, who was assuring fans that most of the guys on the team were 300 hitters. They just weren't hitting 300 at the moment. So if they weren't doing that yet, then they were going to just have a lot of fun getting there. You know,
that's impressive. That's above. Like I was saying, like Kapler was like, is bad, but it's impressive to see someone who is even worse at setting expectations.
I mean, if you're
most of these guys are 300 hitters.
If you're like, look, there's a bunch of disgruntled Phillies fans out there. Who do we got to nail down crowd control? Oh, Greg Jeffries. Get out there and tell people this is all a bunch of 300 hitters in disguise as 220 hitters at the moment. Just, you know, tell, it'll raise everybody's spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them what
Greg
what
Jeffries,
what they're seeing and hearing is not what's happening. Tell them that.
I just love the audacity of it. It's like going out and saying most of our pitchers probably are about to throw a no hitter. They could every day. So just like keep them feeling like they got to. It's fine.
I mean, that's this team in 2019. Except that there was a lot of like it was almost like players had to come out and do their chores, like by giving quotes sometimes, just to be like, you know, hey, we're gonna play baseball and we're gonna do our best, and this is a good team, and like, you know, those are PR answers, but at the same time, they're the only thing you can say, because all I can do when I hear that from this team specifically is say like, yeah, that this is a good team. I mean, it's a good lineup, at least. Like, they should be better.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just not.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And like, it's a, I don't know. Like, I guess like from a, I guess from, I don't know what to say. I guess from like a 1995 standpoint, I sort of understand it a little bit better. But I don't understand the audacity of it from that standpoint. Like, you can get away with it from the lack of access people had. Like, you could be like, the Phillies are going to win it this year. I have a good feeling about it. Like, not really have anything to back it up, more so than today. But, like, you couldn't probably get away with being like, the Phillies are going to win Cy Young MVP and Rookie of the Year and the World Series.
I mean, maybe it's May and you're Greg Jeffries and you're just, like, in a good mood and feel like, you know, stoking the flames and just being like, don't give up on us, fans. If I were a player, I would never speak directly to the fans. Unless we were like running the table. Unless we were like in first place.
And no. Really well. Then you're a jinx once you stop running the table. Then you're like...
Well, Darren Dalton was also notably absent from success at the plate, but fortunately Jim Eisenreich's furious start was picking the team up. On top of their present success, the Phillies were on the cusp of the MLB amateur draft. And for the second time ever, Trev, they had three of the top 42 picks.
Ah, they probably picked some great players.
Probably all the legendary names that I know today. thanks to them losing free agent Danny Jackson to the Cardinals, they were picking 13th, 30th, and 42nd. So you saw hints of the appeal of the concept of tanking from the Phillies themselves. If they had lost their last game before the 1994 labor stoppage had occurred the previous year, they would have been picking 10th instead of 14th. They won that game instead of 13th. Sorry.
I can't wait to hear who we could have picked.
They won that game instead of losing it in 15 innings.
Wow. Just throw a meatball.
Everybody was talking about Ariel Prieto, a mysterious and fascinating, quote, Cuban pitcher who was expected to go in the first six picks out of the Phillies' grasp.
He does sound mysterious.
After him, even Phillies' scouting director Mike Arbuckle would only shrug as far as the Phillies' moves. I can't remember a year when I was less certain about the picks in front of me, he told the Inquirer.
What? This is what's baffling me, I guess. Like, I've been thinking a lot today about, I forget if it was you or John who tweeted it, but like, the tweeting about Andy McPhail saying, if they win, they win. If not, we don't do it. Like, whatever that comment was. Basically, the if he dies, he dies thing from Rocky. But about a baseball team. I think what's so funny about this is, like, it truly feels like baseball has never figured out that there needs to be some sort of, like, veneer between you and the fans when you actually, like BS a little bit. Or, like, say stuff like, oh, yeah, we have a lot of research on Ariel Prieto right now. And, like, or, like, we have a ton of research on this draft. We have, like, 15 guys we might be able to pick. And so they're like, don't know.
I don't know.
Your guess is as good as mine. You got any suggestions?
I mean, this is, like, this is pre-super analytical drafting, too. So this was just, like, you know, all I imagine the stuff you were seeing the old villainous scouts in Moneyball talking about, like, oh, she's got an ugly girlfriend, you know, stuff that...
but, like, Mike Arbuckle was good at this.
Mike Arbuckle was very good.
He's a legendary drafter, and, like, that's his answer.
But, like, what's he going to tell the Inquirer before they draft? Like, oh, this is our plan. You want to take a picture of our war room board?
But just say it in, like, sneakier terms. Like, well, we got a lot of guys we like. Not, oh...
Maybe he meant, I can't remember when I was less certain about who would go in front of the Phillies, not maybe who they were going to pick. You know what I mean?
That's fair.
And looking at this draft, the 1995 draft, there's not, I mean, there's some obviously recognizable and some Hall of Fame names in here, but...
name one.
You suggested that by, and I'm sorry, I kept saying 13th. The Phillies had the 14th pick. By picking 14th instead of 10th, the Phillies... by what I'm looking at, didn't really miss out on anybody terrifying.
Well, see, that's always the way, isn't it? Like, that's always what you assume is going to happen.
But I can't believe that's not what we're talking about.
Right,
but
sure.
They didn't miss anybody that they could have grabbed at 10 that I really recognize. Now, there's people that came after 14 that they should have picked, but, you know, hindsight's 2020 and all that. But Jason Stark in the Inquirer wrote that there was a catching stud out of local Philadelphia school Malvern Prep, who he called a, quote, switch-hitting star of the future. Trev, do you know what this young man's name is? He's a current member of the Philadelphia Phillies organization.
Oh, boy. Switch-hitting stud. Feel like Indiana Jones at the end of The Last Crusade.
Don't close your eyes. Oh no, that's Raiders. That's Raiders. Sorry.
That's right. Well, yeah, I also feel like that. Don't look at the cup of a carpenter. We're in the Temple of Doom. It's the mashup. I don't know who.
That young man's name was Ben Davis, and he would go on to be your favorite member of the Phillies television broadcast.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Fun stuff. With their picks, the Phillies solidified their future, as we know now, with names like Reggie Taylor, Dave Coggan, and Marlon Anderson.
Oh.
Neat.
Wow.
By picking Reggie Taylor at with their top pick, the Phillies let a young hurler by the name of Roy Halladay fall to 17 and get picked up by the Blue Jays. What might have been, eh, Trev? Can you imagine Roy Halladay playing for the Phillies?
Can't. Absurd. It's impossible to imagine. I've actually thought about this a lot, and I think if he was drafted by the Phillies, he just would have... wouldn't have dealt with his mental issues very well, and he would have been a total bust.
Literally, the next thing I have in my notes down is they would have screwed him up somehow.
Yeah,
they
that's the whole story that he had that, like, the highest single season ERA for, like, a starting pitcher with, like, the number of innings he logged ever, and the Blue Jays were like, okay, you got to talk to the shrink. Yes. He's like, okay,
that's
and figured
really
it
funny.
Out. Can that's you imagine really... the Phillies' response to that? They'd be like, toughen up, it's Philadelphia.
The 90s Phillies.
Yeah, I know. They would have just punched him.
They hired a mental health skills coach maybe, 4 years ago? For the first time, I believe.
And I think his actual title was coach of being a giant sissy.
Get in here. I'm going to punch you. Come on in. I'm going to teach you how to think with my fist. So it'd be a different story, and frankly, I don't trust the Phillies to tell it.
No.
So that didn't happen. Whatever. A month later, at the end of June, the Phillies were still hot. And we'll talk about how that month went for them leading up to the game we're going to talk about right after this first break. Well, like I said, Trev, June started. The Phillies were still white hot, still in first place in 1995 as the month of June opened. They were 38-21.
And after still really good.
Yeah, and after 3 months, the success was real. I mean, if I'm a fan, I'm taking that seriously after 3 months. I'm like, all right, look, maybe I entered this series, this season, with not the highest expectations, and also, you know, throw in the fact that I'm a Philadelphia sports fan, I'm going to doubt any success, but, like, 3 months into a baseball season, you're like, look, we're about, you know, not quite halfway. If we're going to enjoy this at all, you know, we got to, I'm going to hold you to this. I am.
I think, like, this is, like, where you get teams that people will still tell you to watch out for, or like to be like a little cautious of, because you get stuff like the what was the one team last year? Oh yeah, the Rockies, weren't they in first place in July or something like that? Like there was like a team. I might be misremembering.
Oh yeah, you are. It's it was the oh, it was the Phillies. Yeah.
yeah. Ooh, set you up nice there.
Thank you.
Huh? Yeah. No, it's there are teams that totally disappoint you and often do, but I mean. Phillies. At a certain, yes, the Phillies, but at a certain point, you just have to, as a fan, you just have to be like, okay, look, like I'm not gonna, I just am gonna get excited about this because that's like what you do with sports. You don't just constantly stay cautious and worry about it all the time. That's like a nightmare way of approaching sports.
Well, if you're careful about the Phillies and you're not quick to open yourself up, that's one way to go about fandom, and it's probably a smart way.
It might be smart. It might be smart. I hope you never believed in him this year, Justin.
I hope we never believe in anything to keep ourselves safe. Gutting yourself during every game is not always the healthiest option, but after 3 whole months, half of which was spent in first place, it's time to consider that the version of this team you're seeing is the team as its real self, mm-hmm, I think.
Right.
So, in fact, the Phillies put an exclamation point on their success by beating the Braves on the last day of June, 3-1, giving themselves a little more distance nice. Between them. Themselves and their NL East rivals. They had just been swept at home by the Reds, sure, and the word panic had therefore been etched into the local headlines, but they were about to embark on a 4-game series with the Braves that could help them gain some ground, and game one went pretty well. They got 7 2/3 out of Tyler Green. The bullpen didn't make things interesting, and the offense chipped away enough at John Smoltz to solidly get the W.
John Smoltz, the bad one of the three.
Eisenreich was still hitting 360 and powering the offense. He also threw out a guy at home plate in this game against the Braves. He didn't make a lot of starts against lefties, slashing only .213 with a .287 on base percentage and .253 slugging percentage against them, as opposed to his bulbous numbers against righties, .341, .398, .517.
That's almost the numbers of that slacker Ronald Acuna Jr.
By the end of June, Eisenreich had played in 52 games and even started in the cleanup spot a few times, which I think even the oiliest of fun-ruining baseball nerds would tell you is a decent sample size. You can judge a guy by
that. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's not great.
I'm not impressed. Nothing
I could
feels
do it.
Me anymore. I'm holding my hand over a candle right now, and I feel nothing. On June 10th, Eisenreich robbed Mike Piazza of a home run in Los Angeles by reaching over the railing and not only taking away a dinger from the Dodgers slugger, but also taking away a souvenir from a Dodgers fan.
Cool.
Is it too late to have a new favorite all-time Phillies player? Good Lord.
This guy's rocking. I love it.
Eisenreich's Sabre bio really glosses over his Phillies tenure without mentioning 1995 at all. But Eisenreich,
I mean, seriously.
This is like a milestone in his career, you have to think. You know, like, yeah, his numbers against righties were, lefties were bad. Like, genuinely very bad. But that's why they knew they were starting him. Like, this is a platoon done exactly right, it seems like.
It seems like it. I mean, who was managing the Phillies at this point?
It's still Fregosi.
Okay. I mean, Fregosi had his moments, I guess. Like, this is some solid management.
I mean, if anybody knew how to, like, that's exactly what they did in 93. And I remember on Continued Success last year when we were talking about the 1993 season.
Which podcast is that? I've never heard of it.
We were talking about at least one episode we focused on, because platoons and matchups and everything factor so much into how Gabe Kapler builds his lineup and uses his roster. Just to see Jim Fregosi, who I don't think anybody's going to, like, mistake for an analytic manager, was doing it really effectively, you know, with players, none of whom were huge Bryce Harper level stars. Of course, you know, when we see Charlie Manuel come back to the Phillies, there was the talk of like, oh, he's going to like undo all this analytic stuff. But like guys like Charlie Manuel were doing analytic stuff before it really had names. You know, they were using some of these philosophies.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think maybe that may, hey, it's no reason to think Fergusi doesn't know how to execute a platoon. It's really not that complex of an idea.
I think this is what's so frustrating about the analytics at Revolution to me is that like a lot of people just assume that people like Charlie Manuel or I mean, Fergusi is a good example. But I mean, a ton of those old school guys like had no idea why people hit. They were just like, well, the stars are in the right alignment, so this guy's going to mash. Like, that's not really how it worked. They had, like, feels for stuff, but, like, it was because they observed a bunch of things. They might not have had the actual words we do, but it was, like, it was a considered decision. Like, it never was, like, random. Like, I'm pretty sure Charlie Manuel was not like, I want this Raul Ibanez guy because he seems like a hitter to me. I look at him and I measure his skull and he seems hitterish. Like, I'm sure he was looking at all the players he acquired and was like, oh, actually, these guys seem like they'll be good because I know what good baseball players are.
Yeah. And I think there's been a certain amount of like, oh, old school is equivalent to dumb.
Yes.
And, you know, like guys, Jim Fregosi wasn't dumb. You know, Charlie Manuel isn't dumb.
No.
Just because there aren't like names that of the things they were doing at the time they were executing them. I mean, they were able to use this kind of stuff to their advantage. And I mean, look at it. I can't believe Jim Eisenreich. Well, it's not like I'm like, why aren't people sitting around talking about Jim Eisenreich's 1995 splits against righties?
I'm saying that. But just got to call my dad. Why didn't you tell me about this?
It did kind of stick out to me. I was like, wait a second. Maybe in something like Jim Eisenreich's Sabre bio, you'd think something like this would come up. But no, didn't get mentioned a whole lot, even though he was the hottest hitter on the team at this point, chiefly because he was being deployed, you know, correctly.
Yeah.
Eisenreich and third baseman Charlie Hayes would both be worthy of All-Star contention, which certainly was a topic of conversation by the end of June. And both would be snubbed from the Mid-Summer Classic in July. But I mean, think about it. He's not playing all the time. Eisenreich would dress and leave the clubhouse before the All-Star teams were announced on July 2nd. He wasn't really, you know, paying attention to
that. He didn't care.
Jim Eisenreich. He was a really low-key guy, you know. But Hayes took a less diplomatic approach, telling the Inquirer, quote, "There are always some guys on the All-Star team that deserve to be there, and there are always some guys on the team that don't."
Dang. That rocks.
I like that, yeah. On June 23rd, when Eisenreich stopped in the Phillies locker room to examine a posted lineup, beat writers were utterly flabbergasted by this team's success to that point. Frank Fitzpatrick of the Inquirer wrote, "The Phillies lineup card, filled with nearly as many unfamiliar names as an Eagles draft, had just been hung on a locker room wall when Jim Eisenreich paused to examine it."
Weird way to frame that, but okay.
"Different," said the Phillies right fielder. "The lineup, not the result. The inexplicable Phillies, paced for a second straight game by a left fielder who was at Scranton 10 days ago, last night clubbed New York 8-2, completing a four-game sweep of the wretched Mets and advancing five games ahead of what must be a stunned National League East field." Thing was, this was the first of only two wins in a 14-game stretch for the Phillies.
Oh, no.
As July opened, the Phillies would take that trust any of their more reluctant fans had put in them, crumple it up, spew that deadened orange tobacco spit that was always festering in the corner of Lenny Dykstra's mouth all over it. The Phillies' frustration started small and became big. Dalton continued to struggle and on July 2nd was ejected for the second time in 3 days, arguing balls and strikes with the umpire.
Oh, no.
Reporters would ask Jim Fregosi if he thought umps were harder on the Phillies at Veterans Stadium, which I'm not sure why, but I guess that was a topic that had to be asked about at the time.
Listen, it's because we're so loyal there.
The umpires just show up like, I hate it here.
I hate all these good fans.
I'm going to call against the team because I don't like them. Fregosi naturally scoffed at the suggestion and thanked the umpires for letting his catcher get some extra rest.
I mean, that's funny, but also a smart move, because if anything is true, if you like about umpires, it's that if you tell them that they are biased against you, they will do their best to prove you correct.
Yeah, And yeah, that's it's always interesting that like that's just considered a part of baseball. They're like, well, don't piss off the umpire, then he will make calls not in your favor. And you're like, hang on, can we talk about that? And they're like, no, that's how it's always been, and it's fine. Well, Fregosi, you know, he was just kind of shrugged at that. But Greg Jeffries was coming off the DL. Andy Van Slyke had been acquired from the Orioles, and so offensive reinforcements were on the way. Plus, the Phillies were 22-9 on the road at this point. Hey, we just got beat 2 games. Nobody's panicking, Darren Dalton said on July 3rd. So
when did people start panicking?
That's the thing is, as the 1995 Phillies went 9-20 in the month of July,
oh no,
and thusly spoiled basically all of their early season success, they didn't do so with a series of swift implosions or meltdowns. If you're us and you're on the hunt for a bad inning in a bad game during
always
a bad stretch,
please at us.
Yeah, we can typically find those with alarming speed, but in this very bad stretch, for some reason, a truly dirty inning was hard to find. Ricky Pitalico gave up some late home runs that cost the team. The inexperience of the rotation started to show early in games. Basically, the stuff that you couldn't believe had been working for the Phillies stopped working. Okay. And everybody who assumed the success was just a mirage got to sit back and say, I told you so. Love those people.
They're always really cool. I actually, one time, I think the best block I ever got was this guy who, I guess we'd been following each other because of Philly sports for, I mean, as long as I was on Twitter. And I think like it was an Eagles game, and he tweeted something like, you know, this team isn't as good as you all thought it was. Like, I told you so. Like, this is just like, why are any of you surprised? And I think I tweeted, shut the fuck up at him. And he just blocked me instantly. I was like, well, that was justified, but I'm glad I did.
You know, they're everywhere. And I mentioned that, I think, on a hitting season earlier in this season, which has been a very frustrating season in 2019.
Yeah, sure.
It's just like, if you're somebody who picks the earliest possible time, if you're part of that first wave of people to be like, this team sucks, they're never going to pull out of it, and your joy of the season is just slowly watching everyone else join you there, because, you know, other than 2 seasons in the history of the Phillies,
that's where they are.
Been a type of a letdown of some kind. Then that's such a, I mean, you know, policing fandom is bad and all that, but that's just, it's like a shitty way to be.
That's just like, it's just like,
are you enjoying yourself?
Yeah. You just like watching people feel bad. You're like, oh, I'm glad that you're sad. Like me now makes me happy, but not in a good way.
I did this tonight instead of talk to my family. So middle-aged Philly sports fans, smug about their own misery. What a treat for everyone. Anyway, in search of an inning that helped propel this one, what's once promising team into the dust, I came across a game against the Expos that contained the type of inning we do here. Less than 2 weeks after Dalton's quote about nobody panicking, the Phillies had lost the first 5 games of August and were mired in a stretch that would see them win 3 out of their next 17. They would lose 20 of 29 games in July, like I said. Their success was always precarious, given the relentless nature of the Braves nipping at their heels. And in a way, it was much like 1993 in that beating the 90s Braves just seemed impossible in the first place. Can you imagine if that had become a habit for the Phillies? The 2010 Giants beat the Phillies in the NLCS.
Yeah.
You know, that was a devastating series that sucked to watch and everything. But I remember one person tweeting out, now we know how the 93 Braves felt. And I remember feeling like that was a really solid, that's a great comparison. Honestly.
Yeah, what a horrible, I think about that a lot, actually. Like, those 90s teams were so dominant. And, like, just they never put it together. Except that one year. Like, I feel bad about 2008 to 2011 only producing one World Series win. Can you imagine like a 15-year period only producing one?
There was a story. I mean, yeah, that is ludicrous that they were unable to win more than one series.
So brutal.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, that period. There's a story. I forget who it is. It might be like Eric Brunlett or Jeff Jenkins. It was a bench player for the Phillies, I think. maybe it was like Scott Ayer, somebody on the Phillies telling a story about Cliff Lee on the team starting in 2009. And I think it was during the 2009 World Series, coming into the locker room, just being like, you know, he's a quiet guy. I don't know if he was really considered a team leader, but in this particular moment, he was talking about how, like, this is going to be the start of a dynasty. This, we're going to win this one. We're going to win the next one. We're going to win the next one. I mean, like, he was just... he was ready to do it.
Yeah.
And we were ready to watch him do it. And it just seemed like they were going to do it.
Yeah.
They were in 2008, that team that won the World Series, as we always say, was not the best team from that stretch of Phillies teams.
No.
So when we say, you know, when you're the better team, like the 93 Braves were when they lost to the Phillies, like the 2010 Phillies were when they lost to the Giants, when you're the better team in every way except the score, does that truly mean you're the better team, Trev?
No, not really. No, honestly, like this is one of those things where people talk about, like, you know, remembering these old teams, and it's fun. Like, it's fun to, like, David Roth makes a wonderful column out of it, and a video column now too, like of the remember some guys stuff. But like, it's fun to remember guys. I mean, this is the whole podcast. But like, if they don't win in the end, then it's fun for fans to remember them. But if you ask anyone, it's going to be like, oh yeah, they lost in the playoffs, didn't they? It's like, you don't get points. Like, the 2001 Mariners, like, everyone remembers them, but mostly they remember, like, oh, yeah, they couldn't win the World Series, could they? That's bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, they remember them because
of how disappointing they were. Yes.
Yeah. So, kind of brutal, but definitely true. So, after the Phillies sat atop the hill in the division of the NL East at 38-21, they would only log 30 more wins through the rest of the season, maybe 31 more wins the rest of the season.
Jeez.
And on July 14th, 1995, I know I said we were going to talk about the game on June 30th, but apparently we're not doing that. On July 14th, 1995, they would log one of their many, many July losses with one of the dirtiest innings of this stretch that I could find. And we'll talk about that right after this. It was a warm night in Quebec when the Phillies headed to Olympic Stadium. The Phillies headed to Olympic Stadium in Montreal, looking to right the ship. Warm with justice.
Ew. I don't like any of this.
Elsewhere, the city was somewhat enraptured in a story of a local businessman in Montreal, Barry Sendell, who had been trying to build a dinosaur-themed amusement park called the Dinosaurium, only to flee the country the year before, $2 million in debt, according to the Montreal Gazette.
It's the worst Jurassic Park spinoff I've ever heard.
Oh, it gets better. He was now wanted by the Mexican police for writing $25,000 in fraudulent checks while trying to open a second amusement park in a remote mountain town, the park being named Caves of Time.
Ooh.
The federal government, in light of the news, yelled that it was revoking any rights Sendell had in regards to starting another dinosaur-themed project at that park. His wife, who was also from Montreal, was a former dental hygienist who was living in an estate with Sendell in a Mexican town until the trouble started. Then she was arrested for fraud, released on 50,000 pesos bail, and barred from leaving the country until officials figured out what the hell was going on.
I feel like that's pretty low bail.
Yeah, I don't know what the exact currency rate.
But even $50,000, pretty low bail.
Pretty low, because at this point, the Dinosaurium Park in Montreal was facing about $640,000 in lawsuits. So
was pulling in $640,000 a day as the most impressive and popular dinosaur-themed park in the world.
I mean, this guy, this Barry Sendell, he's pretty impressive Montreal white-collar criminal. He's kind of amazing. He's got poofy white hair.
Wonderful.
And these big drug dealer sunglasses.
I love him already.
With a dress shirt with the sleeves rolled up, his hands raised in a manner that seems to say, whoa, 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 you got me all wrong, pal. Josh Freed, a columnist in the Gazette, also wrote of, veering away from this story, he was writing this column about what it was like to be a helpless Canadian traveling abroad in Italy, where the technological advancements had replaced the rustic setting he'd once known over there. So I'm just going to read this entire segment because I liked it. all right. Suddenly, it was time to pay our first toll, and a series of automated toll booths fanned out ahead of us. I pulled into one. To my surprise, there was no attendant and no slot for cash. Just a high-tech computer screen flashing a message in Italian. We desperately searched our Italian dictionary till we had the translation. Price, 80,000 lire. Please pay by highway credit card only. A highway credit card? What was that? I stared dumbly at the screen as other motorists lined up behind me, honking their horns impatiently. There were no attendants to be seen anywhere, and my regular credit card wouldn't fit into the slot. What could I do? I inched forward, thinking of leaving without paying, but a barricade came down, blocking my way. Then, a disembodied megaphone began screaming at me in Italian. I had no idea what it wanted. The drivers behind me honked and shook their fists.
Oh, God.
The voice screamed louder and louder. Finally, I noticed a small speaker beside the computer screen.
This is a nightmare.
Help! I shouted into it desperately. I don't know what to do. I am just a Canadian. So that's traveling abroad in the 90s.
It's like it's like the end of that Simpsons where Homer joins the Navy, and he has to tell everyone it's his first day. Like that's the global equivalent of saying it's your first day, being like, I am simply a Canadian.
Help! I'm Canadian. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to picture what he was looking at when he describes a high-tech computer screen. What a 1995 high-tech Italian computer looked like. How deep of a screen did that have? I wonder.
I bet it was like a. I mean, what? This is 95. I mean, you're looking at probably. Oh man, that's a really good question. Was it high-tech? Was it cheap? Was it, boy? Yeah, there's a lot of unanswered questions here that I feel very uncomfortable speculating on.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that was the experiences of a Montreal Gazette columnist traveling in Italy, and indicative of the time that things were changing. People, jobs weren't filled just by human beings anymore. Trev, the computers were here.
That's chilling.
Yeah.
And what of this credit card, my friend? What happened?
Yeah, I wish we knew. That's the column just cuts off there, and the editor like says we're still trying to find Josh on his travels in Italy, but we are not in touch with him.
And he died.
Then he's gone.
Is that true? They couldn't find him?
No.
Oh, I thought it could have been. Maybe I didn't think he had died. Really, I thought that was editorializing. But
well, while Montreal was dealing with the financial crimes of a dinosaur amusement park executive and the travels of a flummoxed Montreal Gazette columnist overseas. Down in Philadelphia, Trev, there was a different celebration going on. Have you ever been to, or were you, they have since discontinued them, were you ever at any of the Bastille Day celebrations in Philadelphia, Trev?
No, but I was at some Bastille Day celebrations in Frenchtown, New Jersey, because my parents my dad and his wife had a still have a theater company that would always do something there. So I like Bastille Day celebrations. I was never to Phillies, but they can be really fun.
They are, and that this game took place on July 14th means it was happening on Bastille Day itself. So the Bastille Day celebrations, I'm sure anyone listening to this is at least partially familiar. The ones they used to have down at the prison on Fairmount Ave, the discontinued prison, the state.
The big one that has the haunted halls, right?
Yes. Oh my God! I was like, I don't need to write this down. I'll just remember it.
St. Thomas.
Eastern State Penitentiary. I was like, it's something state. Yeah, at the Eastern
Pennsylvania
State Penitentiary.
Been
there hundreds of times and could not remember the name.
Been there hundreds of times as an inmate. Justin is 800 years old.
The ones at Eastern State Penitentiary on Fairmount, where they'd act out the scene of Bastille Day and then toss tasty cakes down onto the crowd. They stopped doing it a few years ago.
That's so
but
cool.
In Montreal on Bastille Day 1995, they were still ready to party, which, it's Montreal. It's Canada. There's a French obvious inflection there. So they're going to obviously celebrate Bastille Day. So an alternative rock bar, the kind I mean, celebrated the French Revolution with a baguette fight followed by a water gun and balloon battle. Guests were deemed either royalists or revolutionaries. Trev, how do you view yourself, a royalist or a revolutionary?
Revolutionary. I'm not a big fan of royalism.
That's so cliche. But
sorry, again, I'm just. You asked me to be honest. I don't.
And then, of course, there was... I didn't ask you to be honest.
You're royalist?
I ask you to be interesting, and you fail me every
time. I was going to ask, is this alternative rock bar, is this like a sex thing, or is it a music thing?
Is this some sort of test? Yeah, and you failed. And then, of course, there was the annual two-week construction holiday.
Classic holiday.
Are you familiar?
Actually, yes. In Canada, because the roads get so bad because of the extreme weather, they just basically take off and fix them.
Yes, and I still don't really understand. I read several articles on this, and I actually still don't understand what it is that is going on. So described as it, maybe you can help me, since you know what this is, described as a uniquely Quebec phenomenon, it means the last 2 weeks of every July, at least at this point in 1995, all the city construction workers were given leave, and all their sites were shut down. So the opposite of what you said. Buses and trains ran on limited schedules, and because of this... people just left town en masse. Those that stayed behind enjoyed emptier streets and quieter intersections.
Fun, of course.
Some would argue that by cutting 2 weeks out of July, the province was taking 2 weeks of perfect working conditions for construction workers off the schedule. But
that's
those
weird.
People
so,
were
like,
told...
basically, what I suggested was the good way of doing things. They just said, no, actually, we're going to not do that cool thing. And it just inconvenience people later. Everyone gets 2 weeks off.
Yeah.
I guess that's cool.
Those people were told to shut up and go to the beach like everyone else was doing.
I mean, I would.
It honestly sounds like when the Pope came to Philadelphia, which inspired the Philly Free Streets program, through which they now shut down different thoroughfares of the city at certain points during the year with the mantra, streets are for people. I remember riding my bike around Philadelphia when the Pope was visiting. And downtown, it was great. You don't have to worry about hand signals or being killed, being sucked under a truck, or running into pedestrians who are just darting across the street, not at crosswalks, or getting hit by garbage being thrown out of somebody's window. You could just ride your bike around, walk around. Oh, it was great.
Oh, so you like doing it without the free garbage, huh?
this guy.
This high roller
free garbage.
Here.
Somebody garbage this guy real hard. These Canadian tourists
just went into full Al Pacino there.
These Canadian tourists were said to be headed for the beaches of those fleeing Montreal. They were headed for the beaches of Maine, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. So while the Phillies headed up north to play some ball in Montreal, Expos fans sounded like they were heading down to Phillies territory, which is kind of an interesting switcheroo.
They didn't always travel well, those Expos fans.
No, they didn't. I don't know. And who could blame them? You guys got to come down to America, the northeastern part of America, to watch sports. That's the terrible advice. So they would have found a much more somber, distrustful fan base looking to dive into the worst parts of their fandom once they got down to places like New Jersey. I've learned this year, in 2019, or been reminded, I guess, that it's only the shittiest of most needless voices in Phillies fandom who, like I said, like to announce that the season is over as early as possible, then claim that they called it as the rest of the fans inevitably joined them. The Phillies have a 2-133 record in their attempts to go all the way, so it's not really insightful to announce that the team suck or that they aren't going to get there this
year.
It's actually the simplest, easiest thing you can do. So I've noticed so many fans that can't just be fans. They have to let you know how smart they are. And around here, smart means I gave up on the team first, which how is that fun? How is that fandom? So it's not naive to be along for the ride. That's what fandom is. But anyway, the Phillies were blowing it.
Yeah, clearly. Badly.
So any prophets that had risen up to decry them were being totally validated. Facing Pedro Martinez in Montreal was not going to do the 1995 Phillies any favors.
Let me guess, they didn't hit him very well.
Frank Fitzpatrick recapped this game for the Inquirer, and boy, did he enjoy himself. This is the opening that he wrote in the Inquirer. Suddenly, these 95 Phillies are like hormonal teenagers. They spend most nights making out after out. And after much painful effort, they've learned they can't hide their blemishes. How's that? How's that for an opening to a game recap?
That's really good.
You know what these Phillies remind me of? Horny teens. But he got there. He made it work.
There was a video going around. You should check it out if you can find it. I'm sure it's still like findable on Twitter. But some I think it was like some sort of like D3 or D2 basketball team had this coach who like people kept asking him questions, and every time he had analogies. And like the one was like, you know, team right now, just like a woodpecker in a petrified forest, you know, just gotta keep looking out for opportunities. Just like, I cannot get enough of that stuff. That is so good to me.
Simpler way to say that, but yeah, no, and at this point, you know, maybe you're close to halfway through the season. You're starting to come up with ways to entertain yourself, I would imagine. So yeah, he made it work. Tyler Green lasted only four innings, July 14th, 1995. Kyle Abbott couldn't clean up the mess, and the Phillies' bullpen didn't have much to do while the offense failed to come through. But Pedro of the Expos cruised right on through the Phillies' lineup, throwing eight innings, allowing six hits and two earned runs.
I mean, you can't really blame them for not being able to hit Pedro.
I can prime, blame them prime whatever Pedro? I want, frankly. But no, I won't blame them for that. Yeah.
Sorry for telling you what you could do, sir.
We were probably still learning what Pedro was at this point.
Yeah, this is very early Pedro.
Yeah. This was quite a lesson in who he was. I mean, yeah, it was the bottom of the third that led to the trouble for the Phillies. Rondell White, coming off a 4-for-5 night in the previous game, won by the Expos over the Phillies, walked and stole second. Tyler Green then walked David Segee as well, putting two runners on with no outs.
Not great.
Yeah. Tyler Green got Will Cordero to go down swinging, and then Moises Alou came to the plate. It was this plate on which most of the coverage would dwell. Like, not all-star Charlie Hayes had hit a long fly foul ball with Dave Hollins on third earlier, and Hollins had scrambled home to give the Phillies a 1-0 lead.
Okay.
That lead evaporated the second Alou's grounder reached Kevin Stocker and led to the error on which the game's momentum would pivot.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah, that was a double play ball, Jim Fregosi said later. That turned it all around, the whole game. Mm. He's been struggling. He certainly has not played as well as he did in 93. Saying that about his own shortstop, Kevin Stocker.
Saying that about Kevin Stocker. He didn't play as well as he did 2 years ago.
Remember 93? That glorious season that will live in our memories forever?
Swilling Coors Light.
Well, this ain't that. Yeah. Stocker fudged the grounder, which bounced off his glove and into left field. Fregosi blamed the top spin that Moises Alou grounders typically came with, gaining velocity on the second bounce. He said this. See, I mean, Fregosi, on the ball here, you know, like, oh, very aware of details. Like
he just knows all the special grounder types that people have.
Oh, yeah. He's really got them on index cards, I think.
It's fairly
yeah.
cool. I like that.
Sure. The fudging allowed Rondell White to score, David Segee to reach third, and no outs to be recorded on the play. Moments like this were how they had gone from five games up to five games down in the division. So Expos catcher Darren Fletcher followed with an RBI double. The floodgates now open.
Is this, I mean, can I interrupt? Is this what you think people mean actually, or what it actually means when people, when you say like playing to their talent, like when in baseball your record always ends up, you know, reflecting your talent, where like, you know, you can get lucky for a while and then all your luck kind of comes in buckets and the bad luck actually is just your actual talent level?
Wouldn't this be regressing to the mean?
Is that right?
Isn't that what this is? I mean, I feel like it could be either.
Yeah, you know? I wonder if this is what's meant, like if this is like a vision of it where it's like, oh yeah, you just think you're getting bad luck. But actually what that is just realizing that all the other stuff was good luck.
Well, and there's a certain point in a season, and, you know, looking back now, it's probably, you know, after the All-Star break at some point in my mind, where when you see a guy struggling and he continues to struggle, it's about that time that you're like, you know what, I think we know who this guy is.
Yes.
And, you know, it in baseball, it's tough to drop that measurement on somebody because it's like, yeah, okay, this is where he is this year, you know, and maybe that'll change next year. So maybe that changes my opinion on whether or not this season should be the reason the Phillies do or don't hold on to him. But like by now, you know, it's after the All-Star break. We've seen this guy struggling for many weeks now, you know, 14, 15 weeks. At this point, we know what we have in him.
Getting back to Nick Pivetta talk.
At this point, we can't be blamed for the opinion we have on him.
Right.
You know, we can't be blamed for misjudging him. If he starts tomorrow, nothing but successes for the rest of the year, great. But who in the hell is going to predict that, you know, like,
right. Yeah, no, exactly.
That's the luck component, I feel like.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Like it's everything's so hard to predict in baseball. Everything's so tricky. Everything kind of like has such a long tail. It's not like, I mean, thinking about football, cause it just started this week, like it's so different that you can have these wacky seasons where someone is very good for one season because there's only 16 times that they have to get it right, as opposed to 162.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's what the Phillies were doing. They were just falling back to the team that they were pretending they weren't at this point. I mean, you know, this is 1995 Phillies were off to an extremely hot start.
Yeah.
It wasn't all a mirage, but imagine like if this 2019 Phillies, they were asking a rotation with nothing in it almost to hold them up. And for a little bit, they were in first place. They kind of did it, but that was not sustainable because the Phillies in 2019 don't have a pitching staff that can support a winning team like this. They can't support an offense that sometimes will only give you two runs. And the 1995 Phillies were also that. A lot of young pitchers who would not become veteran pitchers in Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
You know, they were asking a lot from guys whose success was probably based a little bit on luck or based on them pitching out of their minds really well or X factors that people weren't picking up. But there's a reason we bring up Mike Mims and go, oh, that guy, and not, oh, that guy.
Yeah.
You know,
I think like the other thing is you hope for something to really work out in an early season push like this. Like you're thinking, well, look, like if they're just not terrible, like if they're able to be like mediocre, then they bank this and maybe they sneak into the playoffs and anything can happen. But I think more often than not, when that happens, it's like, oh yeah, they're actually just below average. Like with this team, this team kind of sucks, and that's actually just going to be worse to watch.
Well, a team that didn't kind of suck on July 14th,
the Montreal Expos. Yeah,
that would be your Montreal Expos. the catcher Darren Fletcher followed with an RBI double, floodgates open. Tyler Green took the opportunity after that to hurl a wild pitch past Darren Dalton and did manage to strike out Tony Tarasco before the Expos' Shane Andrews singled to left and knocked in another run. Now it's 4-1. Later in the slaughter, which Montreal would win 8-2, Tyler Green would throw what was deemed a retaliatory pitch over the head of Will Cordero following a David Segee home run.
Yikes.
Randy Marsh, the home plate ump, issued a warning. Felipe Alou did a bit of screaming from the dugout, but Tyler Green swore it was innocent. If I was trying to hit him, I wouldn't have thrown it over his head, he explained. So that explains that.
Oh, well, of course.
Green, who had been an all-star for the Phillies, would say later that the long break had impacted him, the all-star break. He'd thrown one inning at the all-star game, but otherwise hadn't pitched in over a week.
Hmm.
And he used that as that was his reasoning there for like, oh, yeah, I struggled for, you know, for that reason.
I love the defense of if I meant to hit him, I would have hit him.
If I had meant to hit him, I wouldn't have tried to hit him in his head. He was saying if I would have hit him, I would have aimed for like his butt or something, you know, not his brain.
Is that what he's saying? Like I would have. I guess that makes sense actually. Now that I'm thinking about it.
Sure. I mean, that's what Shane Victorino was screaming at during the NLCS in 2008. He was like pointing at his head. He's like, "You're gonna throw at me? Throw at my ribs? Don't throw at my head."
Yeah, exactly. Like you crazy.
Unlike
person.
Some players who are like, "Do not throw at me." He's like, "No, I want it. I want the pain."
I understand how this works.
Well, that's how the Phillies lost on July 14th, 1995, a Bastille Day massacre.
Oh, that's nice. I like that.
Up in Montreal.
Can you give us the final score, Justin?
It was 8-2. The Expos won the day.
It's not good.
Not great. But like I said, it was tough to find innings that were complete disasters for this team. They just, you know, they just lost a lot of games eventually. And it was really like, we talk about regressing to the mean. I mean, we said they were 23-9 at the end of May, and then they lost 20 of 29.
It's unreal.
I mean, that's like it's a pendulum swinging back the other way almost exactly. So that's what happens You know, that's when the second half of the season, the Fakers fall away. 95 Phillies turned out they weren't going to be the team that they set themselves up to be, unfortunately. Jim Eisenreich, still, I guess, an all-time favorite of mine now following this episode.
He rocks. But he's so good.
Hey, we've got a couple of weeks left in the 2019 season.
Phillies just lost 7-2 tonight, so that's similar to 8-2.
Couple more weeks of dirty inning farming from the current season. We'll have a couple more episodes for you before the season ends, and then, you know, continue into the off season. So be sure to subscribe, rate, and download all your favorite Phillies podcasts that are a part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hittin' Season with John Stolness, Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher, and of course The Dirty Inning with me and Dr. Trevor Stone. Thank you for listening to this mess of a Phillies game, as we are always happy to bring you on The Dirty Inning, and we will talk to you next time.
Talk to you next time.